You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Joanne Darcy, and you're listening to High Performance Woman Podcast, where we're elevating stories of high performance women from across the globe. Here's what we have coming up for you today.
But toxic productivity is the obsessive, compulsive need to be productive all the time. I kept having these experiences that were building over time, heart palpitations, feeling really dizzy, feeling like I was losing my footing, and I couldn't understand what it was. And I had a pervasive sense of dread. I would feel like something bad's gonna happen. So meeting the real me at first was very disappointing, because I had put on this cloak that I'm strong, I'm resilient, I'm resourceful, I can do it, like I can keep going and going and going. Having that journal process, you're using your cognition, but then you're reading it back and it is bringing you into contact with your much more embodied experience, and you're able to see how the past is showing up in your present and making predictions about your future.
My guest today is Tamu Thomas. She's the author of the groundbreaking book, Women Who Work Too Much, which aims to allow women to break free from toxic productivity and find their joy. She's a transformational coach, a writer, a workshop facilitator, a podcaster, and a somatic movement practitioner. A former social worker, Tamu set up her values-driven coaching business, Live 360, to help over-functioning, overworking, high-achieving women to live and work more authentically, establish boundaries, find their purpose, and make good money. She's also been featured in Vogue, Forbes, ITV, amongst others. Tamu, thank you so much for joining me today on High Performance Woman Podcast. I'm delighted to have you as a guest.
Thank you so much for having me, Joanne. I am looking forward to our conversation.
I want to begin, Tamu, by asking you how you were able to take all of my innermost thoughts and somehow make sense of them and put them down on paper.
Do you know what? I would love to give you some really fancy response, but what I've realized in my career as a coach and observing the women I have had the honor of working with is that because of our conditioning, we are all experiencing different versions of the same thing. And then when I couple that with my training as a somatic coach and all the learning I've done, particularly about the autonomic nervous system, you know, people say, you know, there's no separation and all of that, but we really all are individual parts of one whole. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't surprise me that you say it feels like I was reading your mind or that you feel seen, mm-hmm. because fundamentally we all need the same recipe, maybe in different amounts, for us to be human beings that are able to thrive. Mm. So it pleases me, like pleases my ego, but it also pleases me as a human being because it really speaks to the science of human connection.
Yeah. And I really believe in that interconnectedness of all of us, as you mentioned. And I will admit that I did feel quite triggered at times reading the book. I really felt like I put it down and I felt like there was something wrong for a second. And then I thought, wow, I actually think something is shifting in me from what I had read. It really challenged my longest held beliefs of what was normal. So, you know, I did want to hold it there and read it continuously for the whole weekend, but I actually couldn't because I felt like I had to process stuff as I went through. So for me, it was groundbreaking. And I'd love you to share with our listeners, I suppose, what led you to writing the book in the first place.
My own experience, and just going back a bit, I've always known that I was going to write a book. When I was a child, I was really into poetry. So I thought I was going to write some kind of like poetry book. But when I had my own experience that led to writing this book, which was me being a child protection social worker who was working far too much all the time in a job that is very, very stressful and challenging, not just because of the client group you're working with, but because social services departments are grossly underfunded. So you're working in an environment where there's not enough resources for the job that needs to be done. So that creates its own sort of pressure. I'm a mum. My child was very young when I was a local authority social worker. And I kept having these experiences that I dismissed as a normal part of being a professional person, a normal part of being a social worker, and also used it to chastise myself and tell myself, well, I'm having these experiences because I'm not organized enough, I'm not driven enough, I'm not ambitious enough. I didn't realize that I was chronically overworked. So I tried to do more things because I felt like I was being lazy. I didn't want it enough. I was losing my edge. And I kept having these experiences that were building over time, heart palpitations, feeling really dizzy, feeling like I was losing my footing, and I couldn't understand what it was. And I had a pervasive sense of dread. I would feel like something bad's going to happen. And my colleagues and I, like, this was a running joke. We would say things like, we could do with a minor accident, just a small one, just a little bit of whiplash so we could have some time off. And it culminated with me having some really serious heart palpitations and thinking I was having a heart attack. And I thought, no, I can't continue to work the way I was. So I decided to leave full-time work and become an independent social worker. And it got worse. And there was one day I was walking to court. I talk about that day in the book, yeah, where yeah, I now know I had a panic attack. Still managed to get myself together to go into court because I couldn't let anybody down. I'm a professional. I had to show up and be professional and do what I needed to do to the best of my ability. But in speaking with my GP, because I thought something's really wrong here, and being referred to a psychologist, the psychologist said it's like a layer cake. So she said, what I'm describing sounds like a severe level of moderate depression. I left that depression unchecked and it became anxiety. I left that anxiety unchecked and then I started having panic attacks. Mm-hmm. They were all the different ways my body was begging me to stop. And when I had that experience, I decided that I needed to stop because there's no way. I didn't even really think about me so much. I just thought, I am not going to be a parent who is being sectioned, because at one point I thought I was losing it and I wanted my child to experience me as energized, as vibrant, and I wanted to be a role model for her, like a different type of womanhood. I didn't want her to grow up with the role models I had of what it was to be a woman, which was a lot of sacrifice and martyrdom. So I went and did a course because I love learning. I went and did a short course in positive psychology. And during that, I spoke to the tutor about possible career routes. And he was like, well, you would make a really great coach. And you know, social workers are the coaches of the therapeutic community. You could absolutely do that. And the rest is history, because I just saw so many women living a different version of my experience. And I knew I had the skills and experience to be able to support women to live differently.
Yeah, yeah. I think that will resonate with so many women around what we were brought up to believe, whether it was said or unsaid, the sacrifices, the martyrism. And I think that was one of the biggest challenges for me reading the book was, you know, although I was aware that wasn't normal, or it was normal, but it was never called out before. It was just there in black and white, and it really, really hit home. And I suppose the term toxic productivity, it may not make a lot of sense to people in terms of what that is. So what do you explain toxic productivity as?
Productivity is a healthy part of being a human being. So we are naturally productive, and that's in part the reason why we're the most dominant species on this planet, because we are naturally productive. We evolved, we were like amoebas or something how many millions of years ago, and we evolved into the beings we are. So it is innate within us. But toxic productivity is the obsessive, compulsive need to be productive all the time. So it's when I have a friend who, when we go around to her house for dinner, I don't think I've ever seen her eat the dinner she's prepared. She's flitting up and down. She's serving the dinner. She's making sure everybody's all right. Before you've even finished drinking your drink, she's taking the glass away. It's in the dishwasher. She's always fussing around, always busy, busy, busy. There's always something that needs to be done. And yes, to a degree, that is the case. But if we choose to believe there's always something that needs to be done, and it needs to be done now, and it needs to be done by us, we're going to be trapped in that cycle of toxic productivity. And when we're trapped in that cycle, rest feels dangerous. It feels like something bad's going to happen because we're not using our time efficiently. It's that person in the workplace who, on the surface of things, it's all lovely. You can rely on them. You know, if someone needs to stay behind, they'll volunteer. It doesn't matter how much work they've got on their plate. They will do the orientation for the new person. They may have a deadline for something that is really important, but it's somebody's birthday. We know we can rely on them. They'll get the birthday cake. They'll sort out the birthday card. Someone's having a baby. They'll organize the office baby shower. Or it's that thing where you've got a day off. It's a hot, sunny day, but you are exhausted. But you can't waste the day. So even though you are exhausted, you've got to go out and enjoy the sunshine. You act as if the sun's never going to shine again, because you have got a deep running script that tells you if you're not doing anything, you're lazy, you're unproductive, and that means you're not worthy. So one of the ways I describe toxic productivity is it's really high functioning people pleasing. You're earning your worth by doing something that is commodifiable in some way, shape or form. And that commodity you end up with at the end is your reward. Whether that reward is somebody says you're very house proud, your house always looks like an Instagrammable house, or they can rely on you at work, or they know that if they need help, if they break down in the middle of nowhere, you'll be the person that comes. You get that validation, but that validation is like eating Haribo when what you really need is a banquet. And really and truly, a banquet is made up of different courses, but you're the main meal. Only you can provide yourself with that really satiating, grounding sense of self, and that you are worthy because you're worthy, not because of how productive you are.
Yeah. And the external validation there, there was one piece in the book where you have the diagram of the mountain above the water and then the reflection under the surface. And the words at the top are the positive external validation. One of them I remember is a great multitasker. And then under the surface was can only multitask. Could you explain just some of those other external validations that people may thrive on, you know, if they are in the cycle of toxic productivity?
Yes. So it's things like you're the organizer. So people who are the organizer, you end up being a little bit like the puppeteer. So if you think about somebody who operates puppets, they're always in the background and the puppets are front and center. So you're always operating for other people. You're making sure they have a great experience. They're on show. Their needs are being met and your needs are never being met. And because people are used to you being that person, they will use words like, oh, she's so strong. She's so together. She's so resilient. She's so resourceful. So people don't even consider that you have needs too, that you need someone to organize for you, that you need somebody to lean on, that you need somebody to prioritize you. So you end up stuck in a cycle where you're trying to get those needs met by providing that for other people. And how I describe it is that need, it's a deep need. So because it's deep rather than wide, if you were to think about it like a hole in the ground, because it's a deep hole in the ground, it's easy to step over because you can't see how deep it is, even though you have a good sense. Whereas if it was a really wide need, you could clearly see that you wouldn't be able to cross over that. So we have this really deep yearning on the inside, and we're constantly doing things on the outside, trying to quell that yearning, but we can only ever do that from the inside. But it feels so deep and so dark, we get scared that if we go there, we're going to get trapped. And we're not going to be able to be the highly functioning, resourceful, out there person we know ourselves to be. And that's not the case, because as soon as you start to meet those needs, that really deep, cavernous depth starts to get shallower and shallower because you're actually filling that hole up with your needs. It's things like the thing about a great multitasker only able to multitask. Toxic productivity, like any addiction, is a mask for something. It's something we use to avoid or numb something that feels too painful or too big to actually address. So we're great multitaskers because if we stop multitasking and we focus perhaps on one or two things, we've got space to feel. And when you're not used to feeling your sensations, at first it can feel too much for you. People think it's an exaggeration, but when you're not used to feeling your sensations, it can feel like a threat. You can literally feel like you're going to be overcome and die. That won't happen. Your feelings are within you. Those sensations are within you. They're not bigger than you. But when you're not used to it, and in the society we live in, we're taught to override and suppress our needs, because as far as we're concerned, if we recognize our need for nurture, our need for compassion, our need sometimes to take more time, that gets in the way of being productive. And everything is on tight timelines, expeditious efficiency, everything's urgent. So we are unconsciously worried that we're not going to be able to live up to our own expectations and expectations of others if we slow down and take our time over things. We'll also realize how many things we do that we don't actually like. When you look at that iceberg diagram I've got, it's about like this mind racing. So on the one hand, a mind that gallops, we can often find solutions really quickly, but often those solutions are short-lived because we're creating solutions from a place of survival as opposed to a place of safety and creativity. So we have all of that going on all the time. And those things that are under the iceberg in that diagram are things that are very prevalent in our world of work. When we have a deadline, when we're trying to prove ourselves for a promotion, when we want to ask for a pay rise, all of these things come up because we have been taught to believe that the only way we can prove ourselves as worthy is by constantly going over our bandwidth and going to the point of no return.
And what would you say to somebody who would say, well, that's who I am and I'm fine, you know? Is there ways it shows up physically, or what would you say to that person?
Constant headaches, that need to go quickly, even though you've got an inkling inside you need something different, but for whatever reason, you don't believe you can. So I had a client who had lots of issues with anxiety and lots of symptoms that pointed to having high cortisol, mind constantly racing, heart palpitations, just felt like she couldn't slow down. and she would go running all the time. And I asked her if she would consider not dropping the running, but swapping some of the running, or intermittently swapping between running and walking, and whether she'd consider adding something like dropping one of the runs and doing yoga instead. And she didn't want to. She liked running. She really needed it. It helped her. And I was like, well, if you think about it on a somatic level, when you're running, as much as it's a sport for us and all of that, somatically, the part of our brain, the amygdala, hasn't evolved. That's the like the reptilian part of our brain, or like all of our emotions and whatnot are processed there. Hasn't evolved since we were cave people, hunter gatherers. So when we're running, we consciously know we're running for our health, but to our body, we're in danger. We're either running away from trouble, or we're running to hunt food that we desperately need. So it pumps up your cortisol, it pumps up your stress hormones, basically. And I'm like, you're trying to outrun stress by creating more stress. And she thought that if she did something like yoga, she wouldn't have the cardio, she wouldn't have the stamina to be able to live her life. And she, what I was trying to help her understand is that she's trying to use stress to combat stress. And when your body is younger, you can do that because you have got more energy. Your body is younger, is more able to do that. But as you head towards and get into the throes of perimenopause, you just don't have the same energy reserves you had previously because your body is going through a second puberty and it's not healthy. But she was so worried she would lose her edge. She didn't want to let go of that. And in fact, she didn't until a year later when she started having health issues. So she couldn't keep that up. Another sign is shallow breathing, like constantly shallow breathing. And when you slow down, you notice the parts that are hinges are really tight. So you notice that you're gripping your jaw. You sit down like you like, oh my goodness, like, oh, I didn't realize there was space like in my armpit because I've been holding on. I've been bracing myself. You realize that you're bracing your pelvic region, like you're just holding on all the time. You very rarely feel safe to relax. Another sign is you don't take notes. You're not conscious of what you've accomplished because you've done that tick onto the next. You haven't taken the opportunity to savor and to acknowledge the thing you've completed. So you end up in a situation where your brain ends up being like a laptop with loads of tabs open, simply because you haven't registered what you've done. So you're never getting a sense of completion. Nothing's ever finished. And it's like, I describe it being like stickle bricks. One task sticks to the next task, sticks to the next task. So you're carrying really heavy weight simply because you haven't acknowledged things. And a major sign is sleep disturbance. You find it difficult to fall asleep, or you find it difficult to stay asleep, or you're waking up really early. So these are common signs we experience when we are addicted to toxic levels of productivity.
Yeah, it's interesting when we call it an addiction, because I think a lot of people wouldn't think of addiction as this. But it's all the characteristics, you know. We can be addicted to so many things to avoid what we're feeling, you know. So one other thing that I think I'd like you to talk about a little bit more is the high functioning freeze versus the high functioning thaw. I found that section very interesting in terms of a concept.
So high functioning freeze is something that lots of us experience. So it comes from the autonomic ladder. So the autonomic ladder, we've got at the top of our ladder, which is where we feel all safe and connected. I've got great problem solving skills. Life feels good. If something bad happens, it's not ideal, but I've got the capacity to deal with it. Then in the middle of the ladder, we have the sympathetic nervous system, which is in our survival state. It's about fight or flight. It's about escaping or taking facing danger head on. In a healthy state, it mobilizes us, it helps us get up and going, it motivates us, it's the part our drive comes from. When we say we're passionate about things, that's the healthy zone of the sympathetic nervous system. And then the parasympathetic nervous system, the dorsal branch of the parasympathetic nervous system, that's where freeze lives. That's where we're shut down. We may have loads of racing thoughts on the inside, but we're numb on the outside. So I call it the I'm gonna's. We have these ideas, I'm gonna do this, I'm gonna do that, I'm gonna do the other, but we don't actually have the energy to carry it out. And that is because we are suppressing what feels uncomfortable, what feels unsafe, what feels dangerous. We freeze it. And when we're in that freeze cycle, Deb Dana, who's somebody I learned with, she did a course called The Foundations of Polyvagal Theory. She says that quite often people describe freeze as a blended state of a combination of being shut down and that fight or flight. But in her experience, it's people cycling fight, flight, shut down, fight, flight, shut down. So you've got a lot of energy taking place on the inside. And that can feel really dangerous because it's like a motor that we keep revving but doing nothing about. And rather than addressing the revving, we try and drown it out. So we, you know, our bodies are so sophisticated, we shut it down and we suppress it by utilizing things like mindset, by having a positive attitude, by being really pumped and motivated. So we can find really clever ways to adapt and cope with what we're freezing on the inside by being hyperproductive on the outside. And we're productive with things that we can do out there that take us away. So outside our bodies, that take us away from being inside our bodies and having to face all of the things that have come together that have made the internal experience feel so unsafe that we shut it down. Mm-hmm. Now, when you start to do work on yourself, and you start to cultivate more safety on the inside. So maybe you do a coaching program. Maybe you do it independently. You're listening to podcasts. You're reading books. Maybe you start doing something like yoga or Pilates or Tai Chi or something. Or you start doing therapy. You slow down and you start to consider how your inner world is being projected in your outer world. And when you start to do that, your body is like, thank goodness, I'm being seen, I'm being included. I have a sense that this person now has enough capacity to deal with all the things that have been frozen on the inside. So when we start our personal development journeys, we can sometimes find that it gets worse before it gets better, but it's not actually getting worse, so to speak. It's that you've cultivated enough safety in your body that your body feels like, okay, I can start to bring forward these memories from the past that have been locked away, or we can start to draw her attention to these somatic experiences, these sensations we have. We're going to slow her down so that she can start to feel what resentment feels like. So she's going to start to recognize that feeling that she gets in the pit of her stomach, just as she says yes when she wants to say no. That's actually the beginning of resentment, because you're starting to cultivate trust, and your body, your subconscious, starts to believe there's enough capacity here for this person to begin to process and heal all the things that have been shoved down. And in that space, because it can feel not just frightening, it can feel terrifying and harrowing, especially when we realize how much we have had to do with our own conditioning because of what we've learned. It can feel really heavy. And if we're not careful, we can get into shame spirals, blaming ourselves, being the victim of our own circumstance. So when we can bring compassion to that, when we can give ourselves grace and almost bless the previous versions of ourselves, we can then start to heal it. But there's a very small, there's like a breath that we need to pause at so that we can make the choice to give ourselves grace so that we can truly heal that and start to embody new ways of being. But yeah, it can be a real, real challenge, because we're conditioned not to take responsibility, but to blame instead. And taking that responsibility takes a lot of maturity.
There's so much in that. so much. I think with even the moment or the pause to, you know, talk to ourselves with compassion and grace, even that is a massive step forward for people who are conditioned like this for all of their lives. How do you know, or how would you identify that you're ready to take those steps, that you're ready to start working through some of this stuff, if you've identified that, yes, this is definitely me, that I can, that all of this resonates with me and I want to take some steps forward?
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
In my experience, I have not met one person who has just been like, oh, I've had this epiphany, I need to change. Everybody I have met, whether they have been coaching clients in workshops or people in my personal network, we've got to a point, and I'm saying we because that was me as well, we've got to a point where we're sick of it. We're tired of it. That, like, it's literally feeling like there has got to be more to life than this, and I can't continue in this way. So, you know, warning, you get to a point where you're like, I cannot stand this anymore. If somebody can point me to somebody who says, I was just meditating and I had this epiphany, I would love to meet that person. We get to that point where we just can't take it anymore. And then we're driven to make the changes. Mm-hmm. And that can look like you realize that you're tolerating or you're being tolerated. So I'm tolerating, I've outgrown these friendships and I'm tolerating them because I'm terrified about what will happen when I go for what I want. I realize I'm tolerating and existing in this role, in this job, in my business, but I'm terrified of growing because us human beings, we're terrified of change. There are lots of women I work with who come to the realization that their long-term relationship or marriage either has to change or it needs to end. And that's terrifying because of all of the conditioning we have about marriage being for life, about partnering for life and that kind of longevity. So you need to be sick of it and need to be willing to take the risk of truly living. And when you're taking, one of the things I love about polyvagal theory, Deb Dana describes polyvagal theory as the science of feeling safe enough to start truly living. When we're talking about safety, we're not talking about nothing bad's gonna happen. I'm living in this bubble. I'm totally safe and protected. What we're talking about is having enough safety, you viewing yourself as your safe harbor so that you're able to be risk aware rather than risk averse.
What does that feel like, this concept of feeling safe in yourself?
The easiest way I can describe it is you feel yourself inside yourself. You feel heavier. You feel more grounded. So I had a very visceral experience walking to the post office one day. I could feel the ground. I could consciously feel the ground. And I thought, oh my goodness, like I am literally feeling my connection heel toe with the ground naturally. And most of the time I was walking around all day long doing what I was doing, but not actually feeling myself. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the ways, like you literally feel inside yourself. You start to feel your reactions and responses to things in real time. So you're literally like, oh man, I can't say yes and then send a message later on saying, oh, actually something's come up. You know that it's not a yes in real time. And it means now you're gonna have to say, actually, no, I can't, or not right now, or whatever in real time. when somebody does something that offends or upsets you, you can feel that in the moment. So you don't have that experience where you feel a bit funny and you're not sure why. And then you're in the shower and like, oh man, I should have said this. I should, like, you feel all of that in real time. The difficulty or the challenge with that is you are now in a position where you need to advocate for yourself in real time. Because when you don't, somatically, you're being dishonest to yourself. So you might not consciously feel it, but what you have done is, you know, when you get that feeling, when somebody's telling you something like that doesn't add up, like that doesn't make any sense, like you're not telling me the truth. That feeling inside you get when you know somebody's being deceitful, we have that going on the inside. So once we know in real time, we are left with two choices. One, to honor ourselves and speak our truth in a manner that is kind and compassionate, or two, deceive ourselves, because we've learned it's better for us to feel bad than look bad.
It's so simple, but it's terrifying. Terrifying. So in a simple situation, for example, somebody tells you that we're going out on Saturday night. I've decided last minute, or even with advance notice, we're going out on Saturday night for birthday drinks. And you need to come, you have to be there, etc. And even that feeling that you described. So we're now a little bit more in tune with our body. We can feel that kind of pit of our stomach. That's the start of potentially resentment. What or how do you respond in that moment, compassionately yet honoring yourself?
I would love to celebrate your birthday with you, but that environment is no longer aligned with me. Can we arrange something else?
Yeah.
So you're not saying straight out, no, you're saying, I'd love to celebrate your birthday with you. Can we arrange something else, or let's arrange something else? So you're giving that person an option. Mm-hmm. One of the difficulties we have with that is that we feel bad because birthdays, you know, we're supposed to do what the person wants to do. And we run the risk of severing that relationship. But what I say is that it's not about us having our own way all the time. But if you're saying to that person, that environment is no longer aligned with me, I want to celebrate your birthday with you and be fully present, really enjoying myself, I'm going to provide you with an alternative. What sometimes we're worried about subconsciously is that if that person says no, what that person is communicating is, I don't care about your needs. I don't care about what feels good for you. I don't care about what's going on for you. I don't care about what feels safe for you. I care about you being who I need you to be. Mm-hmm. So who you are in this doesn't matter. You need to be who I need you to be. And then we need to start making some adjustments or decisions about the relationships we have. When we say, I love this, I'd love to celebrate your birthday with you, can we do something else? What you're doing is holding space for both of your needs to be met. And in a relationship, we have this person's needs, your needs, and also the needs of the relationship. And we need to be mindful about making sure that we are meeting the needs of the relationship as well as meeting the needs of each other. When we can get our heads and hearts around that and recognize that a relationship is three entities, you, the other person, and the relationship you create together, we can start making more powerful decisions that are in support of the relationship we share together, rather than individuals trying to get their individual needs met by another person.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. So much sense. I want to kind of get on to, I suppose, the second half of the journey. But a question I ask all of my guests on the podcast, and I'm going to ask you a little bit differently, is that I believe every woman embodies high performance. But what does high performance mean to you?
Well, get a bit sciencey about it. There was a study done, I believe it was in Positive Psychology, that shows that humans operate at their optimal capacity when they operate at around, a human's optimal performance is when we operate at around 80% of our physical and mental capacity. So optimal performance means giving it that, but leaving yourself with a little bit of change so that when you need to expand, when you need to work a bit harder, because that does happen, we do have periods of needing to work, quote unquote, too much, you actually have some wriggle room left in your system to be able to do that. And high performance is also recognizing, you know, we're all cyclical, but especially women and people who menstruate, high performance during your luteal phase, just before your period is about to start, and high performance when you're ovulating are two different things. When I'm ovulating, I'm Beyonce, Michelle Obama, I'm all of those wrapped into one. When I'm not, it's a different story altogether. So it's also recognizing that the level of high fluctuates and giving yourself grace for that. Most of us can identify with certain times in our cycles, feeling like we've done a month's worth of work in 1 week. We need to remember that at the other points in the month when we're not able to perform in that way. So we recognize that high performance isn't based on the just solely on the performance you're doing right now. It's a continuum.
So would you recommend that people plan around that in certain instances in terms of what your month would look like?
Yeah, absolutely. And when I say plan around it, I don't mean we only do challenging work in the spring and summer of our cycle. It's also recognizing what you need in times of your cycle where things are more challenging, so you can put those things in place. Something I recognized when I was like binging through all the chocolate and whatnot, like during the few days before my cycle started, oh, now I know that's magnesium. I've got a need for magnesium. So I make sure that I'm taking my supplements, I'm not messing around, and I'm eating in a way that my body needs, as opposed to like all the strawberry fizzy laces I like so much to make sure I'm supporting myself. It means that when I've got, you know, because I work for myself, when I'm doing like outward facing things, I do try to plan them around my cycle. But I can't always be that way. So it's making sure I'm prioritizing things like sleep and getting adequate rest and like the physical things I need, because we live in our biology first, making sure I've got those things in place so that I can perform at a high level and then have some downtime after that to be able to recoup, restore, refresh after that. Mm-hmm. It's so, so, so important. And it means then that what you're doing is not just sustainable, it's actually regenerative. It's actually energizing you, regardless of where you are in your cycle.
Yeah, it feels so in tune and integrated in terms of, you know, your body and how you're thinking and how you're feeling all in one. Talk to me a little bit about meeting the real you, that part of your book where you talk about that.
Yeah, so meeting the real me at first was very disappointing, because I had put on this cloak that I'm strong, I'm resilient, I'm resourceful, I can do it, like I can keep going and going and going. And I think that's the part in the book where I say something along the lines of, I'd been treating myself like Teflon and realized that I was actually made of silk. Meeting the real me is so much more gentle and tender and soft than the me I had learned to inhabit in order to be successful, withstand the experiences of this world. So sometimes that can feel really harrowing, especially if you're somebody that has worked in a corporate environment, you've had your own business, and you've had to be this kind of type A go-getter to be able to make success, to make strides in your industry. And in meeting the real you, it can also feel quite challenging, because you realize, like for me, I realized how much I had let the real me down, because I was living up to other people's standards and expectations. And that's fine. Like, allow yourself to have that, allow yourself to experience that disappointment. Because in that disappointment and in that kind of like shock, there is so much information and data that's going to support you. Meeting the real me is one of the reasons why I started tracking my cycle. I didn't believe in PMT and PMS and all that before. Like, I used to, in my mind, I was like, this is nonsense. Take some painkillers and get on with it. Mm-hmm. It's only when I met the real me and realized how fragile I am, most of us human beings are, that I was able to take into consideration what brings out the best in me, rather than constantly over-delivering, overworking, overachieving all the time. So it enabled me to have an appreciation for who I am. It enabled me to stop dismissing the parts I find natural and quote unquote easy, and realizing that I find them natural and easy because I've built them over time. It's not something that I was just born with. It's a skill I acquired over time. And then I was able to start structuring my day and my work so that it could bring out the best in me, as opposed to squash. And the best in me is stuff that I used to refer to as weird or quirky beforehand. That's actually my je ne sais quoi. That's my pizzazz. And meeting the real me made it safer for me to bring those parts of me out, like being playful, my childlike curiosity, the fact that I can see a beautiful sunset and actually cry because I'm just like, nature is so beautiful. And before, I wouldn't have done that. And in allowing that part of me to shine, I was able to see, well, that's where people connect with me. That playfulness, that childlike wonder, that like everything is a learning experience. Those are the very reasons why I've been able to do what I've been able to do and achieve what I've been able to achieve. And quite frankly, those qualities of mine have done far more for me than like those kind of like soft skills, we would call them, have done far more for me and my progression than the, I suppose, hard skills and the more strategic skilled parts of my life.
Yeah, I relate to that so much. It's they're parts that you would see as not parts of you for the work environment, not parts of you for, you know, leadership. Yet when those parts are present and you bring them into situations, they're actually, as you say, where you connect with people and where you actually get the most results. So it's amazing to flip the thinking on that completely. So somebody who is in a situation now who this all resonates with, and they want some of what you're describing there, like, how do they go about it, or what's the kind of next steps for them?
So when I first started my journey, I got a A5 notepad and had it in my bag. Journaling is a really supportive self-therapy tool. And I got an A5 journal because I would carry it around with me. And when I noticed I was triggered, when I noticed I was envious, when I noticed I felt small, even when I noticed that Brené Brown describes it as foreboding joy, when the joy feels so good, I shut it down because someone's going to pull the rug from under me. I don't deserve it. And all of those things, I would journal about it. And I would look at what the precipitating factor was. So what led to me shutting it down, or me being triggered or envious or whatever, so that I could start to identify patterns. And those things that I probably would have shamed myself about before became tools. So envy pointed me to when somebody was owning a quality that for whatever reason, I felt ashamed of owning or I couldn't own. I was able to see a part of me being reflected in that person, and they were able to own it. So I was able to learn from that. When I would be triggered about things, oh my goodness, I'd be learning all of this stuff about my childhood conditioning and the things I had learnt. I was diagnosed with ADHD last year, and it was being triggered by people who can just get things done, and reading lots of content about ADHD on the internet. I thought, oh, there's something here. So rather than just being triggered and making it's so unfair and making myself a victim, I was able to do something about it that has given me an appreciation and understanding of myself. It has been looking at my irritation. So irritation is one of my signs that I'm overdoing it. So when I'm tutting, or the FFS under my breath, like, again, I'm being really irritated because people, I can move quite quickly when I want to get things done, being really irritated by people who don't learn or apply as quickly as I could start to see those patterns. And I, you know, God bless him, that irritation, that's my dad. That's what I learned from my dad. Like, it's not quick enough. You children are too noisy. You're supposed to be focused on your work, all of these kind of things. And so I was able to identify those patterns and say, well, if that doesn't belong to me, what does belong to me? What do I want to claim as mine? How do I want to behave? So I was able to start to make decisions about how I want to behave. And it didn't mean I don't get triggered. It doesn't mean that I don't feel envious, but I'm able to pause and know that it's information. I'm able to name it, not claim it. So it's a very, very helpful tool. And most people who are listening to this podcast, to be quite frank, most people who are interested in what I do are very highly intelligent, cognitive people. They can think their way through, they can brainstorm their way through. So having that journal process, you're using your cognition, but then you're reading it back and it is bringing you into contact with your much more embodied experience, and you're able to see how the past is showing up in your present and making predictions about your future.
What I really love about that is that it's real time, and for high functioning, productive women to think about sitting down and journaling is another task. And, you know, probably will be the one that will get pushed. And I know myself, I've plenty of times have journals everywhere. But to actually have one with you that you can do that in real time sounds so effective, as opposed to having it as a task in the morning or in the evening. So, yeah, I definitely will give that one a try.
Sorry, I'll just quickly add, I've worked with clients who the writing hasn't worked for them. So they've either use the dictation function and written it in their notes app in their phone, or use the voice note function in their phone, but make sure they remember to label it so they know what that voice note is about, so they can go back and listen.
Mm-hmm. And I read about the envy that you described there as well, and the positive use of envy, because what it's actually telling you is that you see something that you would like for yourself, not something materialistic. And I think it's just a really good way as well of flipping envy on its head and using it to get to know yourself better, really. Yeah, yeah. In terms of the somatic side of things, for people that don't understand what somatic is all about and somatic healing, could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so the word somatic comes from the ancient Greek word soma, which is like the vibrant living body. So the corpse is the dead body, the soma is the vibrant living body. And somatics, so I trained as a somatic coach. Somatic coaching comes from somatic therapy. And in essence, somatics is about being alive and present with your complete experience. So the sensations in your body, how they lead to your thoughts, what your emotions feel like, where they sit in your body. So you're getting an experience, like it's experiential. So quite often we will talk about mindset. Like mindset, we believe, is the panacea for everything. It is the tonic for all things. But our mind sits on top of our biology. Our biology has a huge impact on our psychology. Polyvagal theory teaches us that 80% of communication goes from body to brain. Our mind deciphers it, and then we take action based on like 20% of that information. So the conscious actions and choices we make are based on all of this data we've got from our bodies. Our body is a really sophisticated sensory system. I talk about it in our book, our skill of neuroception, which is how we sense safety or danger in this world. And our biology is hardwired towards sensing negativity. We've got a very strong negativity bias because that's what kept us alive. Dr. Rick Hansen talks about it as when we were prehistoric man, if we heard a rustle in the bushes, that could be a bunny rabbit, that could be tonight's dinner, or it could be a prey animal or an opposing tribe. So for our safety, and our body is designed to keep us safe, it was much better for us to run from a rustle in the bushes rather than take that risk. So we are highly adapted to sense things in our environment. And that informs who we are and how we are. When we recognize that, we won't just be talking about mindset. We will be looking at what has been taking place in our environment, how our body has responded to that, and then how we act. So somebody I worked with was working with a boss who just wasn't a decent human being, not in their role as a manager anyway. And she was talking about how anxious she felt and how she always felt like she was on tenterhooks when she was around this manager. And she was doing all of this self-improvement. She was learning about doing breath work to regulate herself and all of these other strategies. And I was like, you can do as many strategies as you want to. If your body, under the level of your conscious mind, is detecting danger because that person makes you feel unsafe, your body's going to shut down all of that creative executive function where we're able to make conscious choices from because you're scared. So sometimes it's not just about mindset. It's not just about mind over matter. Sometimes we need to change our environment. So somatics and somatic coaching looks at the body as a whole. And then somatic healing takes us from, so we won't just be using, for example, the journaling as a cognitive exercise. And that's why I talked about what led to it and how were we feeling as we got triggered, so that we can start to understand how these things impact our body. Ah, right. So when I feel envy, I would call it like the elevator going down. Gudung. I could feel that energy going down because I was sad and ashamed. So, right. So that's what shame feels like in my system. So when I feel that, I can actually start to do something about it. And somatic healing, we don't need all of this excitement going to ayahuasca ceremonies and seeing a shaman and this and that. You can if you want. I'm not opposed to that. But it's the gradual, quote unquote, simple things we do day in, day out that have a cumulative impact. So for that shame that I would feel in envy, I don't have to do a big jiggery pokery about it. I would literally put my left hand on my heart, my right hand over my navel, and I would send compassion down from my heart to my navel to heal that shame that was taking place. Instead of shaming myself for feeling ashamed, I met that shame with love. That is profoundly healing. And things like that, day in, day out, you start to build a trusting relationship with your body, you're healing your inner child, and you're becoming a place of safety for yourself rather than a place that shuts you down.
Yeah. It sounds so, it's so good that there's so many simple steps we can take to start that journey, as you say, as opposed to the extreme. What would be your three key pieces of advice that you would give our listeners from your own experiences and life lessons?
My three key pieces of advice would be, first of all, and we're talking about toxic productivity, scan your mind back and see what was role modeled for you as a child that has informed how you function. Because we learn so much from what we see in addition to what we're told. So one of the things I talk about all the time is I'm on a mission to be a well-rested woman. I don't have any role models for well-rested. When I think about it, it was full of the devil makes work for idle hands and all of that kind of stuff. So it's to understand that this is your conditioning. It's not your fault. That's the first sentence in the first chapter. It's not your fault. So take a look at that conditioning so that you can start to create new conditions for yourself. That's number one. Number two, I think everybody not could, but should learn about their nervous system, and particularly the autonomic nervous system. You don't have to spend thousands of pounds on courses like I have. There is a whole host of information on YouTube, for example. There are really great videos on YouTube. I mentioned Deb Dana earlier on. She's got loads of wonderful videos on YouTube, and she's made polyvagal theory really accessible for human beings. So it's not a really dry science. And the other thing I would suggest is, again, going back to your childhood and think about the things that gave you a sense of joy and see how you can begin to weave those in to your life. I don't care if it's that you used to love Fashion Wheel. Fashion Wheel was one of my favorites. And now you do coloring. You spend time doing coloring. Or maybe it's that you enjoyed going round to your friends' houses for play dates. We don't always have to see our friends in fancy restaurants where we're paying a whole load of money and still coming home and having toast because we didn't have enough to eat. We can do stuff like go round to our friends' houses, have games evenings, just sit and chat and have a good time. We totally underestimate the power of joy. Brené Brown teaches us that we cannot selectively numb feelings. If we numb feelings of pain, we also numb feelings of joy. Once I read that quote, I flipped it and realized that if we make more space for joy, we make more space to be able to feel all of our feelings. But those would be the three things.
Yeah. And it was when you were speaking about number three, about the joy. I was thinking back to a time where I wasn't in a good headspace myself, and anything I did that was bringing me joy, I just wrote it down on a little piece of paper and I put it in a little jar. And it was so good then when, you know, you felt like, oh, I'm not feeling great. And you could actually just go and remember what those things were, like simple things. But actually when you're feeling it in the moment, to just write it down, capture it and go back to it then and just pick something from the jar and be like, okay, I'll go and do that. A simple thing. It might be a walk on the beach. It might be, you know, spending time with the dog, whatever it was. But I just found that really useful at the time as well, in terms of those moments of joy. Yeah.
What a great idea.
I ask all my guests for a book recommendation. So I always say, if it's an author, it can't be your own. But I just wanted to make sure. If I was asked for a book recommendation at the moment, this would be mine, because, as I say, it was absolutely groundbreaking for me. Would you have a book recommendation outside of your own?
Outside of my own book, I would recommend A Return to Love by Marianne Williamson.
Love us.
I just found it so nourishing. And that's the book where she does her Our Deepest Fear Is That We're Powerful Beyond Measure. Like that book just felt like a big hug.
Yeah, I agree. I love that book, that we make ourselves smaller. Yeah, amazing recommendation. And what other high performance women should I be speaking to here on the podcast?
You want me to make a recommendation?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I've got a whole list. I've got a whole list of people that you would benefit from speaking to. Somebody who comes to mind, actually, she's based in Ireland. I think she's in Northern Ireland. Her name is Lucy Gernon, and she does a lot of work with women in the corporate sector. Even though she wouldn't describe what she does in the way I do mine, there's a lot of similarities in what we do. And her work is about women who want to, you know, reach the highest heights they can in corporate, but without sacrificing their well-being and their family lives. So I would absolutely recommend her. And I would also recommend Susie Ashworth. She's absolutely brilliant. And again, she's just had a book come out called Limitless Receiving. And she talks about receiving, being able to receive, being something that we've got to work on from the inside out. And her work is absolutely fantastic.
Great. Well, we can chat after, and hopefully you can connect me with those two women. They sound amazing. Tamu, I could sit here for hours and chat through everything I learned from the book and just chat in general to you. I really appreciate you coming on the podcast. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. And I wish you all the best with the rest of your book launch and everything else that you put your mind to.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. I've talked a lot because I'm so passionate about it, but I've really appreciated your question.
Yeah, thanks so much. And it would be hugely beneficial to all of our listeners. So thank you. I really hope you enjoyed today's episode. You can join the High Performance Woman tribe by subscribing, liking and sharing podcasts with your friends and family, and by following me at High Performance Woman on Instagram and TikTok. I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.